Risky Business.
Risky Business.
Risky Business.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Risky Business number 127. I'm Patrick Gray. I should mention that this week's show is not a regular episode of Risky Business. Normally, we do it in three parts, including a news interview up front where we discuss the week's news. And we weren't able to do that last week or this week because I've been on the road. But I assure you that we'll be back to regular programming next week. This week's podcast is brought to you by Microsoft. You know Microsoft. They make all that software you're responsible for maintaining. And big thanks to them for supporting the show. You'll be hearing from Microsoft Australia's Andrew Parsons later on in the podcast about a couple of programs the company is running. And those programs involve giving away an absolute ton of expensive software to students and startups. So it's not technically a security-related interview, but the programs are pretty interesting, which is why I'm featuring them, and also will be of interest to all of the academics and students, and indeed entrepreneurs who are tuning in. More on that later. This week's show is actually coming to you from a hotel room in Taipei. I'm half delirious with jet lag right now, still on my way home from the GovCert Symposium in the Netherlands, and that's the conference run by the Dutch government, CERT. And this week's show features a large excerpt from the plenary talk given there by David Rice, who's perhaps best known as the author of Geekonomics, The Real Cost of Insecure Software. That's his book. I podcasted his plenary from last year's GovCert conference, and it was a hit with listeners. And he's doing a new talk, and it's a lot of fun. He looks at what the security business could learn from food science, of all things, in this talk called Extra Chunky Cybersecurity. The talk is actually a pretty good one to see as well, because he uses something like 500 slides to do a picture show. It's a bit of a different concept. But I did trim a bit from the front of the talk because it didn't really work without the slide deck. But from this point on, it will make sense without the visuals. I should tell you, though, to bear with it, because for the first 8 to 10 minutes, you'll be sort of wondering where he goes with it. But I can assure you it's worth the payoff, so just bear with it. You know, the first 10 minutes is all about Pepsi and pasta sauce. But anyway, here is the Monterey Group's David Rice giving a plenary talk on extra chunky cybersecurity at the GovCert Symposium in Rotterdam last week. Enjoy.
So the story of spaghetti sauce and Pepsi starts with a man by the name of Howard Moskowitz. And Howard Moskowitz, back in the 1970s, there was a new artificial sweetener that came out called aspartame. And Pepsi wanted to use aspartame to make Diet Pepsi. And so Pepsi went to Howard, and they said, Howard, we'd like you to help us figure out how much should go into each and every can, or how much aspartame will go into each and every can, so that we can have the perfect Pepsi. The perfect Pepsi. And so Pepsi told Howard that he'd be working between a band of 8 and 12%. Anything lower than 8 would be too bland, and anything greater than 12, well, would just be far too sweet. So Howard then did what most of us would do. He started at 8%, and then he went to 8.1, 8.2, 8.3, 8.4, and so on until he got to 12%. And he tested this on thousands and thousands of people. And when he got the data back, he was expecting a nice bell curve distribution. It would say, okay, majority of people out there like 9.3%. Great, that's what we're going to go with. That is the perfect Pepsi. But when he actually looked at the data, it was all over the place. In fact, the data was a complete mess. So when that happens in product testing, which oftentimes it does, you just have to do an educated guess. And sometimes you just pick something in the middle, like 10%. And that is what Pepsi did. They just picked 10% and ran with it. But Howard wasn't satisfied. And the question of that bizarre data distribution, well, that bedeviled him year after year after year. So then finally, one day, in a diner in White Plains, New York, the answer came to him. And the answer was, we were asking the wrong question. We shouldn't be looking for the perfect Pepsi, was his mindset. We should have been looking for the perfect Pepsis. And this was an absolute brilliant breakthrough in food science, as it turns out when we look back on it. So at the time, Howard said, oh, this is great. I'm going to go broadcast my message on the road. And then the problem was, no one listened to him. They all thought he was out of his mind. I thought it was crazy. No perfect Pepsi. There's perfect Pepsis. What in the world do you mean? Well, that all changed one day when Campbell's came to Howard. And Campbell's makes, or at the time still does, made Prego spaghetti sauce. And that was interesting because Prego was in a wrestling match with Ragu. Because Ragu was the 800-pound gorilla in the market at the time, and Prego just could not capture any dominant market share against Ragu. And so what the thing about the struggle that really confused the folks at Campbell's was that, technically speaking, through all the focus groups they had done, that Prego was actually the superior spaghetti sauce. So it was superior in terms of the quality of the tomato paste, in terms of the spice mixture, it was much better, more robust, and of course, it adhered to the pasta. That is, Prego sat on top of the pasta, whereas Ragu ran to the bottom. And we're all used to that first picture because, well, gosh, that's what spaghetti sauce should look like, right? But that's only because we're used to it now. So Campbell's then went to Howard and said, please fix us. We can't get any market share against Ragu. Fix us. So what Howard did was not look for the perfect spaghetti sauce. He went and looked for the perfect spaghetti sauces. And so what he did is Howard went to the Campbell's Soup Kitchen and made 45 different varieties of spaghetti sauce. And he varied it in every possible way you can imagine, in tartness and sweetness and tomatoiness and visible solids. Every way that you could possibly alter this, he did. And then he went on the road, and he went to New York, he went to Los Angeles, he went to Chicago, he went to Jacksonville, he went all across the United States. And month after month after month after month, Howard finally came back with a mountain of data. And what's interesting, what Howard discovered was that people fell into three buckets. Those that like plain spaghetti sauce, those that like spicy spaghetti sauce, and those that like extra chunky spaghetti sauce. And this is important because during the time, you couldn't find extra chunky spaghetti sauce in any supermarket out there. And so Campbell said to Howard, are you telling me that 30% of the population out there likes extra chunky spaghetti sauce and no one is giving it to them? And Howard said, yes. And so Campbell's then went out and made their Prego extra chunky. And that was amazing because now they became, in less than a year, the 800-pound gorilla in the marketplace and earned $600 million over the following 10 years. They dominated the market completely. So this was a revolution in food science because what had happened, it created 40 different types of mustards, 36 different kinds of spaghetti sauce, 71 different kinds of olive oil, and at least, by my count, 28 different kinds of coffee, and heaven knows how many different kinds of ice creams. So you just had this absolute explosion in terms of how food science people responded to their customers. Now, what's important here is to realize why Campbell's actually went to Howard. And in many reasons, when they said, hey, fix us, it was for all the same reasons that Pepsi came to Howard. I had to figure out how to get that picture in there. I couldn't resist. So they came to Howard, and it was all because all the food service guys, all the food industry guys, were driven by a notion of a platonic ideal, the perfect Pepsi, the perfect Ragu. The perfect Ragu. So whatever it happened to be, it was all about the one. It was about the pinnacle. It was about that thing that we could judge between the best and not the best. It was a way, one way, in which the food industry could treat all of us the same. Because there is this pinnacle of spaghetti sauce to aspire to, and if we make the perfect one, they will come. So Howard showed us something very important, that appetite and taste does not exist on a vertical scale. There is no one ketchup or any mustard or any spaghetti sauce that's better than the other. Okay, that was the idea that dominated the food service industry, the concept of a platonic ideal that drove it for many times. In fact, what Howard really showed us was a concept called horizontal segmentation, that there's no real one better spaghetti sauce, but different people fall into different groups of what they prefer in terms of their spaghetti sauces. So that was powerful. So what fundamentally Howard did was democratize taste. He democratized taste and made it available to everyone because now you are recognizing individual tastes of large groups of people instead of trying to force everyone down to the one perfect true taste for ragu or whatever it happened to be. So when we start investigating our different appetites, whether it's regarding appetites for food or appetites for risk when it comes to cybersecurity, the Platonic ideal, actually for the pinnacle, the notion of the gold standard by which we can judge everything, even if to figure out you're compliant or not, it kind of hurts us more than helps us. In fact, it really trips us up. And as Howard would say, that this notion of a Platonic ideal is not only a mistake when we're trying to implement it in the market, it does us an enormous disservice. We start not being able to recognize the details in the population that are so very, very important when you're trying to service your customers. That is the problem of low fidelity. That is, the concept of perfect is the concept of one, and the concept of one is really the concept of two, because there's this and that, there's perfect, there's not perfect, there's the perfect ragu, and all the other stuff you guys eat. But this is the perfect ragu, and you should like it because it is perfect. So this low fidelity is a big problem for us. So when we look at all of our converging cybersecurity standards, they all, again, start to preach the same list. We need to step back a little bit. We need to step back a little bit and consider what Howard could possibly teach us about cybersecurity. And there are five possible lessons here. The lesson one is this. Cyber criminals are not our customers. And yet, when you look at the security industry, if you considered it a business, we spend all of our time focusing on the attackers out of necessity. But when we start talking to cybersecurity professionals about their customers, what their needs are, what it is, it's, well, I don't know. I don't know what they want. When we start looking at all the attackers, I can point to mountains of research we've done on malware, cyber criminal activity, cyber crime, just mountains, just coming in left and right. Go over here, and we see next to nothing in terms of investments on our customers. And what Howard taught us was you must know your customer. Now, we have to pay attention to cyber criminals out of necessity, but when we turn around after have learned about what cyber criminals do and turn around to our clients and our customers and say, you have to do A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, L, M, N, O, P, and then they don't do it, well, maybe we're missing something. And there's nothing so apropos than this story. This was run by Computer World, and this was talking about the White House cyber coordinator, otherwise known as the cyber czar. And General Jim Jones in the National Security Council and Larry Summers in the National Economic Council all had play in terms of how this role was actually formulated. And when you look at the comment here, it says the National Economic Council has, quote unquote, taken the stance that too much emphasis on cybersecurity will hamper economic growth. The argument appears to be that too many security requirements will result in new operational costs, hurt growth, and limit efficiency. And when I wear my economics hat, I have to agree with Larry Summers. I have to. Why? Well, it's pretty simple. Because when we look at it right now, if we implement cybersecurity as we've currently envisioned it, well, he's right to say, well, gosh, you know, we're kind of in a huge financial crisis. And if you guys make a spend out the wazoo to do A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, H, I, K, L, M, N, O, P, you're going to kill us. Now, the irony is, back in the Clinton administration in the late 1990s, the Clinton administration's stance was, well, we can't spend on cybersecurity because it'll hurt our boom. It'll hurt this magnificent growth we've been experiencing. So boom or bust, cybersecurity has no place. Now, Mr. Summers and General Jim Jones are not fools for ignoring our message. We are fools for repeating it so many times across so many years because these guys know what they're doing. If we cannot convince our nation state executives that the way we've envisioned cybersecurity is a good idea, then we have some serious thinking about who our customer is. We spend a lot of time on cyber criminals out of necessity. I'm not saying we shouldn't. But we don't focus on our customers. We're still scratching our heads about what message resonates. And part of that is because number two, or reason number two, you can't ask people what they want. And that's another lesson that Howard taught us. Remember, Campbell's ran all of these focus groups. And they said, well, gee, you know, this product is superior. It's got better tomato paste. It's got better seasoning mix. It's got all these wonderful things. Why aren't we dominating? Why aren't we going forward? And it's because the way they were collecting data was skewed. Sometimes people don't know what they want. You've got to start experimenting, researching with and collaborating with the customer to discover what it actually is that they need. We can take all this wonderful knowledge that we're investing in research and development and researching into vulnerability research and cyber criminals, but we're not spending any energies or monies transforming that message into something that resonates with the customers. Why don't they buy cybersecurity? Because we're not selling it to them. We're selling them fixes based on a customer that we've assumed is just the cyber criminal. But cyber criminals are not our customers, and we have to do a better job of understanding our customer base. The third lesson that Howard Moskowitz gives us is that there is no perfect security. There are only perfect securities. There is no perfect security. There is no gold standard that all of the agencies in the world are going to be able to abide by that's going to reflect a disparate risk posture by all these different operating entities with all these different operational needs, all these different market forces. It's a difficult proposition for them to abide by. We're trying to make our jobs easy by automating all this. That's the scalability issue of compliance. But at the same time, it's not responding to or reflecting the nature and essence of what our customers are trying to do with their lives. We need to, in essence, do what Howard Moskowitz did and democratize cybersecurity. We need to make it available to everyone simply in such a way that the package is consumable. Okay? So the other thing that Howard teaches us in this lesson is that maybe, just maybe, cybersecurity isn't necessarily a vertical hierarchy. That is, we've got this great, wonderful gold standard that if you abide by, you'll be really good, or you'll have at least a good chance of defending yourself. Okay? Maybe, just maybe, we need some extra chunky cybersecurity and extra garlic cybersecurity and really sour cybersecurity. I don't know what it is. But maybe we need to actually abide by, when we start talking about risk, have our compliance regimes actually, I don't know, support that statement. There's a famous line in The Princess Bride where Inigo Montoya is looking at, I forget the master's name, but he's like, you keep using the word, you know, inconceivable. I don't think it means what you think it means. And it kind of is the same thing in risk with cybersecurity. We keep using that word, but none of our actions really back that up because all our compliance regimes shove people down into a risk bucket that they don't want to be in. So why do you think they try to get out of it? Because they don't want to be in it. And we keep jamming into one risk bucket that will fit them all. One ring to rule them. One ring to bind them and in the darkness mess up their lives, right? So we need a little bit better reflection of what's going on. The fourth lesson here is that the most powerful revelations about cybersecurity are yet to come. And they have nothing to do with cybercrime. They have nothing to do with malware. They have nothing to do with how governments respond to the cyber crisis. It has everything to do with how we end up communicating with our customers, finding out what they actually want to buy, and giving it to them, while wrapping in all the other stuff that we need. And as Bruce Neer said, hide some of the darn complexity. Hide it from them. We're horrible marketers. We're wonderful technologists, but we're horrible marketers. And any business needs to market and know its customers. So the big revelations, I feel, downstream are yet to come, and they have nothing to do with what we think is traditional cybersecurity. As cybersecurity starts to evolve and mature, we need to consider how we would act like a business, deliver value regularly, and maybe not directly to the client, maybe through some other service provider. Somehow, some way, deliver it to them such that we now engage with customers in new and exciting ways. And then finally, five, the fifth lesson. Our futures are shaped by the questions we ask. When you look at the question that Pepsi asked, or looked at the question that Campbell's asked, okay, it was predominantly driven by this notion of a platonic ideal. That is, what is the perfect Pepsi? What is the perfect ragu? And our answer, or our questions, have been, what is, you know, really effective, broad, comprehensive cybersecurity? And maybe, if we really want to initiate change in cybersecurity, we have to start asking better questions. What are the flavors of risk in the environment? What are the packages of security that people prefer? I don't know what those questions are, but we need to ask better questions ultimately because the questions that we ask shape the futures that we have. And if we don't like our current reality, which was the future's past, figure that one out, okay, it's probably because we didn't ask the right questions 10 years ago. Do we want to go 10 years forward in time and still not be asking the right questions? Because that's ultimately what leaders do. Leaders disrupt status quo. leaders are the great disorganizers. A great quote by General Colin Powell. He says, good leaders are not organizers. They are rabid disorganizers. They go out and change status quo. They challenge things to make sure that they're done differently. And what leaders do is ask all those pesky, annoying questions. We're like, oh, God, what's he asking? But there's a reason why. Because questions create the futures that we will have. And if we ask the wrong questions, we will get the wrong futures. So maybe, just maybe, if we apply one of these lessons, we might see a revolution in cybersecurity. Maybe, just maybe. It's just something to think about. So thank you so much for your time tonight.
That was David Rice's plenary session from the GovCert Security Conference in the Netherlands. The team at GovCert had me over there to attend as a journalist and also to do my own little talk on social media manipulation, which was a lot of fun. Big thanks to all of the GovCert people, Ellie, Ilko, Tarek, Ruland. It's just not possible to name everyone, but I would like to single out Eric de Jong for special thanks. He took me out for a beer on my last night in the Netherlands and actually put me up in his house for the night. So, Eric, you're a class act. Thanks again. Now, before we get to this week's sponsor slot, I just have to share this. This is really funny. So I'm here in my room in Taipei, and just a 36-hour stopover, and all of the toiletries are individually wrapped. And on them, the following is written. I'm not kidding. In such a crowded and nervous city, I refuse to be the same. In my own way, with my own style, I want to be myself. As free as a fish walking along the city, free my own pace as I wish. Now, what I love about it is it mostly makes sense and then just completely goes off the rails. Fish walking on cities. still, it's all very well and good for us English speakers to laugh about this, but I'm sure Taiwanese people have a good chuckle when they come to the West and see 22-year-old women with tramp stamp tattoos on their lower back saying pogo stick wisdom banana or words to that effect. Oh, how I wish I was a fish to swim in the deep blue sea. Oh, how I wish to be a fish and one day soon I'll be. Could be the jet lag kicking in. That's probably why I think this is so funny. Anyway, moving on to this week's sponsor interview. And last month I was at Microsoft's TechEd conference, some listeners may remember, which takes place every year on the Gold Coast. And I ran into Andrew Parsons there, who is a former journalist who now works for Microsoft and handles its academic programs. Now, he mentioned a couple of the programs that the company has been running that allow students and entrepreneurs to get their hands on free software. As you'll hear, there's no word yet on whether they'll be doing a similar sort of program for security researchers. My gut instinct says no. But as I mentioned in the intro, there are a lot of entrepreneurs and students and lecturers who listen to Risky Business, so I thought this would be a reasonable deviation from the regular sorts of topics. So I actually got Andrew. I didn't get a chance to interview him at TechEd, but I got him on the line after I'd returned and did a phone interview with him about these programs. And here is that interview that I recorded with him before I left for Europe. Enjoy. Now, Andrew, when we spoke at TechEd, you mentioned that there's a whole bunch of programs that would allow all sorts of different people to get their grubby, undeserving little mitts all over some very expensive Microsoft software for free. Tell us more.
Well, I wouldn't say undeserving per se, but I run all the academic programs here in Australia, particularly for higher ed students. And last year we launched a program called DreamSpark, and it sort of started off for a whole raft of Spark programs. DreamSpark allows any student in Australia to actually get their mitts on a whole bunch of software at no cost. All I needed to be is a student, part-time, full-time, higher ed, high school, you know, college, whatever you need. And you know, it's not just simple stuff that you can buy for $50. We're talking the professional level, professional quality stuff. We're talking Visual Studio Pro, the 2008 version, the current version, SQL Server, Windows Server 2008 R2, so you know, absolutely current software. Expression Studio. So, you know, students get everything they need to start doing software development in pretty much whatever form they can think of. Even if they want to go down the games development route, they can actually get stuff there. If people can get their hands on stuff like the servers, Windows Server, you can really get into it and play with it. But, you know, normally it costs you, you know, a little bit of cash. DreamSpark allows you to get into that and really dig down deep.
Yeah, because a lot of the, you know, younger student-y hacker types would generally just try to pirate this stuff, and it's, you know, so that they can do research on it. But this just would make life a lot easier for those types of
people.
That's
right. You have no worries at all about, you know, anyone actually randomly finding you and cracking down on you. You're getting this software legitimately at no cost.
Mm-hmm.
And you can really start hacking into it and then checking it out. And to go along with that, we actually do stuff for educators as well. We've got this other program called Faculty Connections. So any lecturers who would really love getting into security and networking essentials and all that kind of stuff, really want to get down into the depths of it, they have a very similar set of software they can get their hands on as well. But in addition to that, there's more than 10,000 pieces of resource, curriculum, you know, assignments, exams, lesson plans, all that kind of stuff, as well as, you know, professional development stuff that they can teach themselves and really get into it. And one of them, notably, is, you know, Windows OS resource kit, which really dives into the depths of the building blocks of the operating system itself.
Mm-mm. So, like, even if I'm studying 17th century French poetry part-time, I'm still eligible for this?
That's right. If you're a student, that's the thing. Student.
Now, obviously, this excludes things like Office, which are already offered as a commercial student edition, right?
That's right. So DreamSpark is all about, you know, more the sort of the geeky stuff, right? That, you know, you want to do development, or you want to look at creating a website, or you want to start looking at servers. So DreamSpark is the four I mentioned: Windows Server, SQL Server, Visual Studio, and an Expression Studio with a few extra bits, right? So there's XNA Game Studio for games, there's Robotics Studio for, you know, getting into that sort of robotics embedded sort of stuff, a few other bits and pieces like that. But they're the core four pieces of software. But those four alone are, you know, not worth, you know, a couple of bucks. They're worth quite a few.
It's funny, you know, because we do live in a Microsoft world, so I imagine there are plenty of people out there who would really like to study this stuff. But when you start talking about academic kits available and lesson plans and stuff, it reminds me of that episode of The Simpsons in the School of the Future. I know you know what I'm talking about, where the kid says, oh, if Jill has one Pepsi and her friend gives her another Pepsi, how many Pepsis does she have? And the answer is something like delicious, you know, refreshed. It's a little bit like that. You would agree? Well, you're not allowed to in your job, but you know what I mean, right?
Look, I love doing this stuff. You know, I've been playing and messing around with technology for a very long time, and I just wish this was around when I was a student.
Yeah, right? Yeah. Well, it's the tobacco company model. Get them hooked young.
Well, when DreamSpark first sort of launched, maybe a couple of people actually said that, but we've actually gone on because of the success of the program, because we've had so many students taking it up and actually becoming really promising in terms of looking at that technology. There's a couple other Spark programs that have actually launched since then.
You told me about this one. BizSpark, which is for the entrepreneurs who want to get cracking and don't necessarily have the upfront costs for all the licenses and stuff.
Exactly. So BizSpark gives startup companies, you know, for the first 3 years, access to a bunch of software, and they basically get it for 3 years as long as they don't earn more than $1 million. You know, after then, we figure they can probably afford it.
But yeah. That makes sense, actually. But I guess, you know, that's also an interesting style of program, isn't it? I mean, it's not one of those things like the novated lease on a car where you get some crippling balloon payment at the end of the 3 years, is it? I mean, this is a total write-off of licensing costs.
That's right, yeah. So you're basically using it for the 3 years. So if you are a student and you start with DreamSpark and you sort of have that sort of a bit nervous, I don't know if I want to lock myself into this because I don't know if I'll be able to make something out of it. I think you can personally, but, you know, there's some people who are going to have that sort of hesitancy. You know, BizSpark can give them that security that once they graduate and they want to go out on their own, you know, they've got some support there as well.
Has Microsoft ever considered offering a similar program just to security researchers? As in, you know, we'll give you the software as long as you're not going to put it to commercial use and you just want to do some security testing on it and, you know, share the findings with us before you go public, you know, responsible disclosure and all of that. Because to me, that just strikes me as a good way for Microsoft to get some good free QA.
Look, I to be honest, Pat, I can't actually answer that. It's completely out of my zone of you know, anywhere near what I can understand or know. But you know, we are looking at other things. You know, just last week, and the official launch comes in a couple of weeks' time in Australia. We did Website Spark, which again is part of the Spark initiative, and with Website Spark, we're basically looking at small web dev companies. You know, 10 or less employees. You know, get a copy of Windows Web Server, SQL Server Web Edition. You know, help you. You know, host your sites. You know, we partner up with hosting partners, all that kind of stuff. If you go to websitespark.com, you'll see it's already live, and you can get an idea of what you can get out of it. Again, very similar set of software, but aimed at a different audience yet again. So.
Mm-hmm. So, do you happen to know if your sort of enterprise competitors like Sun, Oracle, IBM, do they offer similar programs, or is this just something you guys are doing? As far as you know,
this is fairly out there in terms of, you know, the big commercial companies wanting to sort of, you know, help people get that software that's traditionally worth, you know, thousands of dollars into the hands of people who, you know, just can't afford that.
Mm.
Yeah.
Okay. Andrew Parsons, thank you very much for taking some time out of your no doubt hectic schedule to have a chat to us here on Risky Business.
Thanks, Patrick.
Microsoft's Andrew Parsons there, and that's it for this week's show. We'll be returning to regular programming with full news interviews and stuff like that and news analysis next week. I'm actually a bit homesick at the moment because I've been away for a couple of weeks, so I'm going to go out musically with a bit of good old-fashioned Aussie folk music. Now, if Dave Dittrick is listening, this is for you, because I know you're an American Paul Kelly fan. You like this Aussie folk stuff. You're like the only American Paul Kelly fan. Now, this isn't Paul Kelly. It's Dan and Al. Hardly anyone's ever heard of them, but Google them. Same sort of stuff, but really good. A little bit obscure, but lots of fun. I've probably played this track before, but whatever. I'll try harder next week, I swear. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening. Clear the freeways. I'm coming home.
Sweet dose of regrets above the floor. Pour your tears all down the drain. Put old hat out with the cat. She's coming back again. Plan your troubles in the backyard. Park your headache in the drive. Cool your heart, knocks in the icebox. She's coming home tonight. Yeah, she's coming home. She's coming home tonight. Yeah, she's coming home. She's coming home tonight. And when you left for Sydney, a broken shell remained. These empty halls from door to door were twisted like a maze. And now the locks are open, the planets realigned. And nothing really matters, cause she's coming home now. She's coming home tonight. On the line, an ice pack on your heart that's cracked. She's coming home tonight. A broken promise in the kettle, the steam will carry it away. I leave a dream lit on the doorstep. She's coming home to stay. Yeah, she's coming home. She's coming home tonight. Yeah, she's coming home. She's coming home tonight.